This is DomesticPreparedness.com. Since 1998, Domestic Preparedness has been a source of solutions for the professional preparedness community. Your host today is the managing editor, John Morton.
Domestic Preparedness is with Craig Coy, the President and Chief Operating Officer of the Homeland Security Group at L3 Communications. Prior to coming to L3, he served as the Chief Executive Officer of the Massachusetts Port Authority. And there he oversaw Logan International Airport, the Port of Boston, the Tobin Bridge, and Hanscom Field in Bedford. While at Massport, he led the implementation of Logan's nationally recognized 100% baggage screening program, which was the nation's first permanent system approved for a major U.S. international airport. Craig served for over 20 years in the Coast Guard, where his service included tours as the Chief Operating Officer for activities in Europe and as Director of the Commandant's Strategic Planning Office. In 1983, he was the first Coast Guard officer selected to be a White House Fellow. And at the White House, he worked with President Reagan's domestic policy advisor before going on to serve as Deputy Director for Counterterrorism at the National Security Council. Craig, I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with us today.
Thank you, John. It's good to be here.
Well, let's first look at the overview of L3 for those who might not be familiar with the company. L3 Communications is now the sixth largest defense company in the U.S. and, among other things, a leader in intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, and also secure communications. If you would, tell us a little bit about how you're leveraging this defense expertise and technology in the homeland security arena.
Thank you, John. Well, as I said, it's really nice to be here, and I appreciate you coming by to speak with me. I was really excited, am really excited, to be a member of the L3 team now. I joined L3 about 8 months ago, and one of the reasons I wanted to join L3 was because of its really distinct and vast, unique capabilities in the area of homeland security. As you mentioned, it's the sixth largest defense contracting company in the country right now. It's also just cracked the 200 barrier as a Fortune 200 company. It's celebrating our 10th year this month, as a matter of fact. So it's a very exciting time to be at L3. One of the things that I was asked to do when I came on board was to look to see how we could leverage the variety of capabilities and technologies that L3 is bringing to the table in the area of defense, and how we could leverage that into the homeland security arena. It's a great opportunity. It's also a great challenge, quite candidly. The homeland security market is one that's still evolving, still emerging, if you will, in many ways. And the defense area is one that's quite mature and quite robust right now, as you know, with the activities going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. But if you look across the board at L3, as you mentioned, in the areas of command and control, surveillance, detectors, sensors, there's a great capability that could be leveraged into the arena of homeland security. It also goes into the area of crisis management, training, various services and IT providers that could be measured. I think L3 is now in the top 10 or top 20 as an IT provider to the government as well. But more particularly, L3 is the largest provider of detection of explosive devices and detection and surveillance of material that could be brought into any kind of a critical infrastructure, be it an airport or a port or a facility of any sort. As you know, L3 is providing the explosive security devices across the country and across the world for airport checked baggage, as well as checkpoint solutions, as well as cargo solutions. So there's a whole array of opportunity that L3 has to serve the homeland security market, and I don't know a company that's got more capability, more dedication, and more commitment to that area.
Well, Craig, you head the Homeland Security Group, and there are three divisions, Security and Detection Systems, SafeView, and CyTerra. If you would, give us a quick rundown on what solutions those units specifically are providing.
Yeah, John, I'd be happy to. Security Detection Systems is the largest piece of the business right now, and they manufacture, design, and service the explosive detection machines. And these range from desktop units, if you will, that are used as at building entrances, mm-hmm. to large cargo detection devices, gantries that can inspect the containers that go on ships. Also sell the metal detectors, as well as a variety of other machines of that type. The capability of the machines range from very simple X-ray to very sophisticated rotating gantries that provide a full 3D image of what's inside of a container. The two newer divisions are SafeView and Cytera. And SafeView has a product that we're really excited about, and I think we're going to start to see some real traction taking hold in the U.S. market. They manufacture an active millimeter wave body scan device, and we're going to start seeing some tests of that this summer at three major airports around the country. Right now we're told it'll be tested at Phoenix, at LAX, Los Angeles, and at JFK in New York. And this is a device that is non-radiating. It's not X-ray, so mm-hmm. there's no potential of any harm or any radiation to anybody. It works on sound waves, if you will, mm-hmm. active millimeter wave, and it bounces the sound wave off of your skin, and it allows a detector to recreate an image, mm-hmm. Which is excellent at finding anything that could be non-metallic or metallic or any object that's on your skin that's not part of your body. So it's a tool that's going to, I think, revolutionize the checkpoints. Mm-hmm. Cytera, we're going to put these companies and get them working very closely together. It works in two major areas. One is also in radar millimeter wave technology, but also in a trace technology. The radar is being incorporated into a new mine detector that is being fielded right now to the U.S. Army and to military around the world. It's a device that's it's a revolutionary piece of gear that really fuses the metal detection that a typical mine detector has with a ground-penetrating radar. Mm-hmm. And it has allowed troops to clear fields at an unbelievable rate and an unbelievable accuracy and capability. And importantly, it's also being used in the humanitarian fields as well to demine fields around the world that have been left behind as the troops withdraw. The trace detection capability that Cytera has is going to be going into the TSA's lab for final testing here very soon. It is an energetic material detection, and it will detect any high explosive or any high energy material, whether it's legal or illegal, liquid or solid, and provide indications of the presence of a potential explosive material. Mm-hmm. And I think this is going to also revolutionize the checkpoints and other handling of material. The devices that are out there today, as your listeners know, detect a certain library of explosives, mm-hmm. and this eliminates the need to have that library. This will detect anything that could possibly create an explosive device. So we're very excited about these technologies and these potential product offerings that will be coming out.
That last point, eliminating the need for a library, that suggests what you have algorithms that can kind of anticipate and cover things. Tell me how that.
The science behind it is that by definition, anything that's going to explode has high energy, mm-hmm. and so when you apply heat to it, the high energy material will put off a signature higher than the inert, if you will, material that's around it. And then we're developing the algorithms that will eventually be able to identify precisely what it is that is the high-energy material.
Excellent. Now, you're providing solutions for all three levels of government, I suspect, in addition to the transportation sectors, state, local, and federal. Can you elaborate a little bit on who your customers are and would be?
Sure, John. Be happy to. Interestingly enough, L3, as you know, is predominantly a U.S. DOD company. But in the area of homeland security, and particularly in this group that I'm managing now, 70% of our business is international. And so most of our business is in Europe and in Asia, supporting not only airports but seaports and other types of facilities with our various products. Obviously, we are selling to the TSA mm-hmm. and to other federal agencies, and then we're also selling to state and local agencies mm-hmm. as well as to the private sector. For example, the SafeView body detector, we've sold a unit just recently to the county sheriff in Colorado mm-hmm. For his courtroom. Mm-hmm. The judges there and the law enforcement folks in that jurisdiction were concerned about people coming into their courtrooms with things that may do harm to the officials there in the courtroom. And rather than have pat-downs and have a lot of people there for checking people, they've determined that this is going to save time, save money, and also provide a high level of security. Mm-hmm. We've also deployed a similar device with a financial services institution, because one of the threats that people see in these institutions is the idea of people walking out of their facility as much as walking in, but walking out with critical company data. And so this is used to detect hidden CDs or data sticks that could be on individuals, and so that you don't want to have your most critical data walking out of your business at night.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, let's look a little bit at how the detection systems and the scanners and so forth are figuring into what I think you're calling the integrated checkpoint system idea, what have you. Tell us what makes that solution unique and where you have the applications.
This is really very exciting, John, and I'm thrilled that we're having an opportunity to talk about it and also to see if we can make some progress on this. As your listeners probably know, particularly those that fly, if you look around at the airports today, the technologies that are at checkpoints as you go through is virtually unchanged from the 10th of December, 2001. Mm-hmm. And this is an area that TSA is very much focused on right now, mm-hmm. is to improve the technology and the capabilities at the checkpoints. And we're putting together all the technology that we've brought to bear so far into a new integrated checkpoint, which will combine essentially five technologies into a single solution that will have an integrated awareness picture for the operator at the checkpoints to be able to make a real educated determination as to the status of that passenger going through the portal. It will have the trace detection capability that will automatically, in every case, attempt to detect traces of material on a person as they walk through the portal. It will have the active millimeter wave body scanner, so it can detect things that should have been taken out of your pockets and out of your off your body and put through the X-ray device there. And it will also have a more advanced metal detector, which will allow the operator to see a quadrant or to see an area in which metal may be present, rather than simply trying to guess that. All of that information will be brought together and presented to the operator in a single mm-hmm. display. While that's happening, as the passengers' carry-on bags have been put on the belt, every one of those bags will be put through an X-ray, but an X-ray with automated detection capability, algorithms, if you will, that can assist the operator in determining what might or might not be in a bag.
Mm-hmm. And sort of an anomaly.
It will, and it can have some intelligence, say, with it. And it will also have the ability to adjust on the fly, if you will, so that when new threats are identified or specific threats are being looked for, we can adjust that algorithm. And so that will be brought through on the checkpoint as well. And probably the most important thing for most of us and for the TSA will be that the integrated checkpoint will have an automated bin return, so that the instead of having the bins stack up at both ends of the checkpoint and being manually carried back and forth, it will have an automated belt returning the bins and keeping that movement flow easy. Our target is to be able to process 300 people an hour. And I will tell you, having run a major airport, 300 an hour is almost double what is currently going through. Most airports, most checkpoints are realizing somewhere between 75 and 125 on average. So this is a really outstanding opportunity, and one in which I know TSA is very interested in taking a good look at.
Let's turn now to talking about another area that you're working, and that's interoperable communications for first responders. Now, here I understand you're emphasizing the linkages to the EOCs, correct?
That's right, John. One of the things and one of the persistent areas of interest and criticism, if you will, is in the area of interoperable communications, where one police department can't talk to another fire department, or a fire department can't talk to an EMT for various reasons. This is an area that we've seen time and time again where it occurs. And we think that we've got a variety of solutions, by the way, that can satisfy a great part of this problem. We have a capability that is in today being deployed with the DOD and with the U.S. Coast Guard, which allows the DOD and services and the Coast Guard to work interoperable communications with anybody they come across. And this is a great opportunity for us to take a technology and a capability that was developed and fielded for the military and see if we can transfer this into the Homeland Security arena. And the essence of the way it works is that it is agnostic, if you will, as to whatever the communication device is. It is a it's a switching capability which can take any type of voice communication and link it with any other type of voice communication with a push of a button. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take programming. It doesn't take a sophisticated operator to do this. And it also allows the various state and local agencies, when they choose not to be interoperable, to not be interoperable. Mm. One of the challenges in this area is a culture of the various jurisdictions that are deployed around the country. I think most of your listeners would recognize that and understand what I'm talking about. And the other is, in many cases, a management plan or communications plan of what to do when there is a disaster or when there is an emergency. So that's why we think at various levels in an area or in a region, there will be an emergency operations center. And whoever is going to be connected up and managed within that emergency operations center should be able to talk to one another. And this device and this capability will allow that to happen. And then across the emergency operations centers, if two emergency operations centers can talk to one another with this capability, anybody in emergency operations center one can also talk to anybody in emergency operation two. Mm-hmm. And we can nest and build these things together such that we could build a network which would, using existing equipment, allow anybody to talk to anybody at any level of government or at any location. Mm-hmm. We've tried to put this thing together in a way that is affordable to state and locals, and we're working with the DHS, the Science and Technology Divisions, and other parts of DHS to identify ways in which we can make this aware to state and locals, as well as to help them find funding opportunities for this.
Now, I've seen in some of your corporate documents that you see the interoperability solutions coming from statewide plans that incorporate the local plans and inputs. I think you're stressing the importance of the locals. Is that a fair statement?
I really do. It's my experience having run the Massachusetts Port Authority that in the area of homeland security, domestic homeland security, the first responders and the local officials are going to be the ones on the scene attempting to make this thing work. And I think that our focus needs to be at that level because we're supporting them. It was the New York Fire Department that ran into the building on 9/11. It was the New York Fire Police Department that ran into the building on 9/11. It was the New York Port Authority officials that ran into the building on 9/11. And those are the people that we need to get some help to and get some technology to. And I know that the states, various states, are working to find those solutions and to find those plans. And the governors of each of the states are responsible for making sure that their individual states are prepared for these disasters, whether they be natural or man-made.
Mm-hmm. Now, DHS is beginning to talk about all hazards regional response and encouraging thinking in terms of regional approaches. For your interoperability solutions that are locally driven in view of the mutual aid agreements and what have you, do you see an understanding that it has to be regional as well, so it's not just, doesn't stop at the state, that you know, there's a regional component? And how would you put all that together from the standpoint of comms?
Well, I think that, as I say, with what we suggest as a solution, and there's others, I'm sure, that are out there, I think it's a layered plan in which, as I say, from an emergency operations center at the local level, there would be, and you nest those across a state, for example. And then above that, there could be emergency operations centers which have responsibilities for multi-jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. And above that, there would be emergency operations centers at a national level that could also be brought together. And I think if they're pulled together in a layered and a nested capability, at the end of the day, that would allow, in theory, a fireman from Los Angeles to speak to a fireman in New York City instantaneously. Mm-hmm. It's not out of the realm of possibilities, and I think it's a matter of taking some leadership and taking some steps to make this all happen.
Now, if it's driven from the local level, though, how will the states be able to best develop a comprehensive funding strategy, and one that includes the long-term maintenance costs, which are considerable? It's not just acquiring, it's also O&M.
No, there's no question about that. Obviously, the federal government has committed a significant amount of money in areas of grants, state and local grants that are out there as well. I think that the solutions that I'm suggesting are not terribly onerous in the terms of costs in these things. We're targeting something under $500,000 for a very sophisticated, very capable system. It could be much less than that, depending on the size that's necessary. And the O&M is also relatively modest. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. One of the challenges with the grant programs is that you can buy a piece of equipment, but if there's no O&M capability alongside that, sometimes these pieces of equipment get put off into the corner and never really used. And so we put in place at the Massachusetts Port Authority a more detailed process that before we went in and asked for grants, or before we went out to look for grants, we wanted to make sure it was, A, something that we really wanted and something we really needed, and that we would have the capacity to support it in the aftermath. And that was an important step for us to take.
Now, I notice elsewhere in some of the L3 materials that you stress the importance that training and exercises can reveal interoperability gaps that result in the solutions. explore that anticipate solutions. Can you specify or point to any examples where that's occurred and what resulted once they were identified?
Sure. I know that parts of L3 in our services group have been working with DHS mm-hmm. as well as a variety of states in preparing and implementing a variety of exercises mm-hmm. That go back and test the capabilities and test the procedures. I know that at Massport a year and a half ago, we conducted one of the largest training exercises up there, in which we tested the threat of an aircraft delivering a dirty bomb, if you will, mm-hmm. into Boston. And we actually deployed F-15 fighters to escort the plane in from Otis Air Force Base. We deployed the rescue teams, both at the federal level as well as the state police hostage rescue teams. And we literally deployed first responders, having volunteers on board the aircraft made up to look like they were injured or part mm-hmm. of this. Actually driving these people to the hospitals and mm-hmm. And doing those types of things. And we uncovered any number of challenges and potential problems in the area of communications mm-hmm. Where ambulances from other jurisdictions were showing up but, mm-hmm. but couldn't speak mm-hmm. or couldn't mm-hmm. get onto the net, if you will. And so we took it upon ourselves to take some actions locally there in the Boston mm-hmm. area. And there's an old saying at the first responder level that I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, that the last thing you want to be doing at a disaster is exchanging business cards. Sure. So if nothing else that these exercises do, it allows people to get into a room mm-hmm. Out of their normal comfort zone and out of their normal day-to-day work and look across the table at the person that they may end up seeing in a disaster, and develop those relationships and develop that sense of confidence that when they ask for some help or when they ask mm-hmm. for something, that they're going to get it. And so these exercises are terribly important. We always learn something. No exercise is perfect. Mm-hmm. As everybody knows, as soon as something happens, the plan is good, but the plan goes out the door as soon as the first action is taken. But you got to have a good plan to start off with as a basis.
Now, actually, as you recorded in the after-action phase, the interoperability gaps, though, what actually happened when you had identified them? Have they actually translated to solutions yet?
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, we ended up with after-action reports, mm-hmm. and we challenges or discrepancies or issues that we wanted to address. And then we put teams together to mm-hmm. address them, working with the Massachusetts State Police, with mm-hmm. the City of Boston, with the federal agencies that were local there, as well as the regional communities that were up there. So in some cases, it may be that new equipment was mm-hmm. purchased. In some cases, it was understanding that this is the plan. Mm-hmm. A lot of this is a management plan. Mm-hmm. The frequencies are perhaps available mm-hmm. on the radio. But if the people operating the radio don't know that, and it's not put on the tag or it's not put on the box, that this is what you want to do or this is the process that you want to do. So some of it is, most of it is tedious, but it's important management.
Craig, it sounds like that the experience of the Massport exercise, you came up with an identification of the interoperability gaps, and you dedicated some management time to figuring out what the solutions are. Are the solutions management? Are they a product or process or a combination of all three? And if so, are they translatable to other jurisdictions?
Yeah, John, I think you've touched on it. The first step is clearly management. This is something where we took a great deal of interest in, and we took the reports and we took the feedback that we got to heart, and we sat down and put our teams on it to solve some of the problems. Mm-hmm. So it's a process to sit down and understand exactly what's going to happen in a variety of scenarios, in a variety of things. And as most of your listeners know, whether it's a man-made or a natural disaster, in many regards, the effects are the same. Mm-hmm. And then there's the need for technology. There is a real need for technology here. And that's what I was trying to talk to earlier about the suggestions, that some of the capabilities that we've learned and we've deployed with the L3 products in the military.
Mm-hmm.
These are for people that have to have a rugged solution, a simple solution, a non-technical solution, if you will, in the sense of the user interface, and one that can be quite reliable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're suggesting, and very affordable, by the way. State and locals have limited budgets. They have, in many cases, limited technical expertise. And so one of the things that we're trying to do is to help deploy some of that technical expertise with our service teams that we have, providing the ability to go out and run these exercises, conduct mm-hmm. the exercises, and to let them know what's possible out there, that there are solutions to some of these problems, and there's people here to help. We're also working with DHS to allow them or to suggest to them that they can help state and locals in this area by identifying technical solutions and technical processes that could help in this really critical area.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's it's a wealth of opportunity here for solutions that are going to help the first responder in a crisis situation. The last thing you want to be able to have to do, having been an old Coast Guard helicopter pilot, is to be hovering offshore trying to find somebody and then having to translate your requests and your communications through about three people.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And by the time you get it back, the situation has changed mightily. Mm-hmm. And instant, reliable, and safe communications is critical in these types of environments. Mm-hmm.
Craig, in this section, I'd like to talk a little bit about seaport security. I know recently you spoke on transportation security, notably at the 6th International Public Safety Counterterrorism Conference. Now, as an official who has managed both airports and seaports, let's first hear your insights on where we stand in transportation security and where we're going, and then we'll drill down a little bit to
okay.
the seaports.
Happy to, John. There is a significant difference in many, many ways between airports and seaports, but I think there's lessons to be learned on both sides. Since 9/11, I think we'd all agree that most of the funds and most of the efforts have gone toward the aviation side of the issue, and I would say rightfully so. We've seen a lot of the threats have been aimed at the aviation area. The point I was trying to make in my remarks in Canada were it's now time to go after some of the other transportation venues, seaport, port security, mass transit, rail, and those types of areas. Specifically in the area of port security, I think one of the challenges we see is that at a national level and at a policy level, there is no single official responsible for seaports. And seaports are critical to our way of life, to our stream of commerce, and the challenge we have in transportation security is to keep the wheels, wings, and ships of commerce moving, and which is the lifeblood of our economy. And in the area of airports, from an overall standpoint, the Federal Aviation Administration is in charge of airports. And they oversee the way in which airports are built in terms of infrastructure, in many ways how they're managed, and then also how they're funded. Unlike seaports, which has no advocate or nobody in charge of seaports, and particularly nobody in charge of port security. So I think the combination of no single official in charge is one of the reasons we haven't seen much movement in mm-hmm. port security. And probably just as importantly, if not more importantly, is the ability to have a funding stream for
yeah.
port security. And I think that there are many lessons that could be learned from the aviation side of things that could be applied to seaports from those aspects to fill a critical gap I think all of us recognize is in the port security, maritime security area.
Well, do you have a sense that we could get stakeholder buy-in for an approach that might guarantee a funding stream through a commission or an administration?
I would hope so. Mm-hmm. Maritime is a fascinating industry and a fascinating group of industry participants. It's very difficult to find buy-in on any single issue mm-hmm. in the maritime area. But I think if there's one area that we can find buy-in in, it's on security. Mm-hmm. And so I would hope that we could find some buy-in on security. I know that many companies, shipping companies, are awaiting some leadership or awaiting some guidance mm-hmm. from the government as to what to do. The port authorities are local agencies. Most ports in the U.S. lose money. Mm-hmm. And they are underwritten, if you will, by local communities, either state or local coffers through additional taxes that are levied. So gaining funds for security in an entity that's losing money mm-hmm. is a real challenge. So I think there's a possibility to do something that would make it more like an airport. Mm-hmm. And I've offered a couple of ideas on those potential solutions.
In terms of your experience with aviation, I'm sure you brought some lessons learned as to how you went about securing Logan, what have you. What lessons learned translate to a seaport environment?
Well, first of all, there is no single solution. I think that's everybody would agree to that. Second, there's a need for a layered approach. Third, there's a need for an adaptable approach because methods, capabilities, technologies, threats are constantly changing. So to get locked into a rigid solution, I think, is going to be a difficult challenge. But that doesn't mean we don't do nothing. We do, mm-hmm. do something is the approach I would suggest. The one specific area that I've been suggesting lately is that in the area of airport funding, if you look on your airplane ticket out of most major airports, there is something called a passenger facility charge, PFC. And at most major airports, it's about $4.50. And that is a relatively new program, about 10 years old. But I think most in the aviation community would say that it's been a terrific success, although they might not have said it at the outset. Mm-hmm. And in this program, this passenger facility charge, or PFC, is collected by the airlines, and 100% of it is turned back over to the airport authority, who then use that revenue stream to issue bonds. And those bonds are used to build and to buy things. Mm-hmm. Now, in the seaport arena, there is no comparable methodology or no comparable funding stream that's available to the ports to go out and buy things. They compete in the marketplace by doing whatever they can to bring a ship into their port to offload a container, and even at that, they end up losing money. And so to have additional money for port security is a real challenge. But if there were a fee that were connected on containers coming into this country that was then turned back over to the local seaports and not sent to Washington, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. sent to the seaports and allow them to issue the bonds and to raise the capital so that they could build and buy things, I think that you would have a funding stream mm-hmm. and you would have the ability of the local authorities, the local mm-hmm. port authorities, to be able to understand what their needs are, mm-hmm. what their security requirements are, and to build them appropriately. Certainly there'd have to be some approval or oversight or mm-hmm. suggestions or recommendations as to what would be built or what could be built in a general sense, but the actual implementation of that would be done at the local level.
Well, a lot of the seaport security issues are indeed part of a global issue for security. It's intermodal, supply chain, and so forth. Yeah. Place a little bit of port security in the context of the intermodal security.
Well, as you say, it starts at the origination, mm-hmm. and in our case today, we have a balance of trade issue, principally with Asia, mm-hmm. in which a lot of containers are coming in from Asia and Europe and other places, bringing a lot of material in. And there's surely a need to ensure that the containers, when they leave, it's always better to have them safe when they leave than to wait until they get here. But if you're not guaranteed or assured that they're safe when they get here, and there's a lot of vagaries that go into the transportation of containers, I think we have to have something in place on both ends of the spectrum. But as you say, these containers are very mobile. They come into a port perhaps on a truck or a train. Mm-hmm. They're transferred at some other point, put on a ship, brought into this country or into Canada or into Mexico and put on a train or a truck and delivered to wherever they are. And each step of the way, there is a possibility for mischief or a possibility for something happening to these containers. And so I think it's a full court press to try to find out what we could do on these things. But what I've seen so far is there's been a great deal of emphasis, a great deal of effort on this area. And most of it is done in the area of intelligence gathering and in paperwork monitoring rather than the actual physical ensuring that the containers are what they say they are.
Craig, before we go, I'd like to ask one more question, and that relates to standoff detection technology. I know you mentioned the passive millimeter wave approaches that you're looking at. Give us an insight into where you see that field going and where your company is taking it.
Well, the whole issue of standoff is very relevant. The idea is to try to push the threat as far away from the target, if you will, and begin the analysis and begin the identification of the threat as quickly as possible. And so we've, particularly in the area perhaps of IEDs, which we've all read so much about and heard about, L3 has a task force, internal task force, that we've put together to see what capabilities, what technologies we have within the L3 family that can bring to bear on that issue. We've done some testing. We've participated in some studies. And we think we have some technologies that I can't get into today and some capabilities. But we all know that the threat lies in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places. And the concern is that someday that threat will be on these shores. And so we're already thinking about that. We're working on that. And hopefully we'll never have to use it, but it's something that's surely on our minds and something that we are taking very seriously.
Well, Craig, thanks very much. It's been great, and I appreciate you taking the time to be with us. And thanks again. Thanks for your service to our country.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure.
This has been a Domestic Preparedness podcast interview. Thank you for listening.